Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In Washington, D.C., President Obama signs the Jobs Act. In China, we go inside an iPad factory from production line to swimming pool. And in New York, what one intrepid reporter found out when he investigated matzah. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, April 5th, and it's good to have you with us. A little good news today on the jobs front. The number of new jobless claims fell to a four-year low last week. Now, nobody's planning a party, but the numbers haven't been getting any worse lately. And these days, even that makes for enthusiastic headlines. That's no doubt what President Obama wanted to achieve today when he signed Jumpstart Our Business Startups, the Jobs Act. It's aimed partly at helping entrepreneurs attract investors. But many of the new law's critics say it rolls back way too many investor protections put in place after Enron and the dot-com bust. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has the story.
At the signing ceremony today, President Obama described the Jobs Act as a game changer. Consumer advocates say, is it ever? Barbara Roper is with the Consumer Federation of America.
It has something for everybody except investors.
She says the Jobs Act rolls back requirements that make public the paperwork companies file to start selling stock. Roper says look at Groupon. It had disagreements with the Securities and Exchange Commission over accounting methods.
And all of that was played out in public.
Companies of a certain size can now keep financial information private for a longer period of time. There are other regulatory rollbacks in the Jobs Act. Harvard Law professor John Coates is worried about restrictions on Wall Street analysts that are being temporarily loosened. He's afraid analysts will start hyping stocks again on TV like they did during the dot-com bubble.
People were going on television and in the role nominally as research analysts were selling stock to the public.
In 2003, Wall Street banks agreed to put up a firewall between stock analysts and investment bankers in the same firm. Now that firewall will come down when those firms work with most startups. Jeff Stibel is CEO of Dun & Bradstreet Credibility Corp.
What we're creating here is a Wild West environment.
Stibel doesn't like the fact that investors will lose some protections, but he does support another part of the Jobs Act that allows startups to raise money over the Internet so mom-and-pop investors can get in on the next big thing or lose their shirts. In this environment, Stibel says, it's buyer beware. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So it's one thing to try and create jobs. It's another to know where to find them. And it varies from region to region. Some states have a lot of work, others not so much. So we turn to the people now to tell us where the jobs are.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's here every week for a little attitude check, our weekly segment where we find out what Americans think about the issues of the day. Frank, it's good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Sarah.
Now, you have been looking at this question of jobs and geography. If I needed a job right now, which city should I be looking at?
Oklahoma City.
Why Oklahoma?
Because workers tell us that their employers are hiring the most and firing the least. You net those two out, and Oklahoma City's at the very top of the list. In fact, its unemployment rate more recently is like 5.9%, so it's clearly the place to be. You'll have to pack your bags and move to Oklahoma.
Now, I am guessing, though, Frank, that I would have to be skilled working on an oil rig or something if I were to get a job in Oklahoma City. Am I right?
That may be right. Clearly, Oklahoma is part of that area of the country which has been seeing a boom in energy, but you know, we don't discriminate. We're asking all workers, from those who are fast food workers all the way up to CEOs of companies, is the place where you're working, hiring, and firing. It just looks like Oklahoma City. It has a lot going on in terms of jobs at the moment.
So other than Oklahoma City, is that number one? And then do you have a number two?
Indeed, we do. We have a top 10, and it's not all in the oil patch. Houston and San Antonio, a couple of Texas cities, are in the top 10. Pittsburgh, to be specific, is number two, followed by Richmond, Virginia, and then Nashville in Tennessee, and then Orlando. So we've got quite a diversity there.
Now, what about the worst job markets?
Well, I hate to say it, but where you would not want to be is Providence, Rhode Island. I mean, it's a wonderful city. Don't get me wrong. Rhode Island's a wonderful state. But, boy, the people we interviewed in Providence simply were very dismal workers about telling us that their companies were firing rather than hiring. I mean, it has the dubious distinction of being last on our list.
Now, again, that city was a center of industry at one time. What's going on there now?
Well, obviously not a lot. When it comes to jobs, you're absolutely right. Providence and Pittsburgh, you know, at some point, they were both industrial cities of the past. And Pittsburgh's, at least based on our data, done a lot better job of getting things going than Providence, which is not doing well at all. But it's not just those types of cities. Riverside, San Bernardino, Ontario, California is actually second from the bottom. And then the whole greater New York area, workers there are pretty negative. And then in Sacramento, it's negative. And then Buffalo, New York, it also rounds out the bottom five in terms of our job creation index.
What about these cities in California like San Bernardino? Do we know why, Frank, those are not doing well?
Well, what we do know is that statewide, California has a problem. You know, its unemployment rate is high. The only city, it looks like, in California, big city, that's been able to escape the problems is up there in the San Jose area. And, of course, that's being fueled right now with a big boom in startups and kind of electronic software, Silicon Valley, whatever you want to call it.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of Gallup. The segment we do with them every week is called Attitude Check. Frank, we'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
The mood on the stock markets today, not as bad as the mood in Providence, apparently, but not great either. Details when we do the numbers. On my way into work today, I stopped at the gas station to fill up. $4.35 a gallon in my neighborhood. I was inclined to chew out the station owner until I read today that service station owners aren't too happy with high gas prices either. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins hit the streets of Los Angeles to talk to gas buyers and sellers.
I'm at a Chevron near downtown Los Angeles.
$4.31 a gallon for regular. Alrighty.
To talk with Angelinos about everyone's favorite subject, the price of gasoline.
It's too damn high. I'm really realizing that this is a major expense.
Donald Morris has just paid $57 to gas up his Ford Explorer. A few blocks away at another Chevron, he would have paid nearly $7 more. I found Tom Gladney and his Mercedes there.
I don't really pick gas stations, you know. Sometimes we just try and find it where it's a little bit cheaper.
But why is gas cheaper at one station or another?
The oil companies can do what they call zone pricing.
Taylor Cash owns a filling station in Raleigh, North Carolina. He says the price he pays his distributor is sometimes much more than a station just down the street. Today, Cash is charging $3.97 a gallon for gas. He paid $3.98 for that.
So when you buy a gallon of regular gas from me, every gallon I have to pull a penny out of my pocket.
Cash does a healthy business selling wine, high-end coffee, and breakfast. But he says the high price of gas hurts him, too, as customers cut back.
Now maybe they just skip the biscuit and coffee and either make it at home or just do without.
The National Association of Convenience Stores says when prices spiked 5 years ago, 2% of stores closed up shop, which may have many of them saying,
"It's too damn high."
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
So why do you fill up where you do? We put this question on Twitter this morning. Surprisingly, lots of people said convenience over price. Want to join this conversation? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. You can also ping us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Foxconn, that mammoth Chinese company that builds Apple's iPads and iPhones, says it's got a big pay raise planned for its workers in Taiwan. That's about 10,000 employees. In mainland China, Foxconn's also been under pressure from labor activists to raise wages and investigate charges of unsafe working conditions. That's 1 million employees there. Our China bureau chief, Rob Schmitz, has been following this story closely, and this week he was given rare access to one of Foxconn's factories. He joins us now from Shanghai. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Sarah.
Rob, you were recently invited to tour one of the Foxconn factories in Shenzhen, right?
Right.
Did management give you unlimited access, and what did you see?
Both Foxconn and Apple, who both invited me, really gave me unfettered access. I had really rare access to see an Apple production line, and I saw the iPad line, you know, seeing the iPad and seeing it with its guts hanging out on the assembly line.
Right.
It was pretty amazing.
Now, I understand that you spent a couple of days interviewing workers outside the gates before you went into the factory. What did the workers tell you?
First off, workers at this particular factory had been promised a raise that was supposed to take effect in March. And for most workers I spoke to, this actually didn't happen. So many workers were really upset about that. But at the same time, most workers had a generally positive outlook about working at Foxconn. You know, nearly all of these workers come from rural China. They're the sons and daughters of Chinese farmers, and they live on less than a few dollars a day back home.
Yeah. Did you get the sense that they know that they are at the center of a very big story here in the U.S., that, you know, they're in the headlines here?
This was a surprise to most of the workers I talked to, and this was something that I asked, the dozens of workers I spoke to. I read some of the stories that we've seen in the press in the United States. A lot of them either snickered or rolled their eyes about what I was telling them. The general message seemed to be, well, you know, I've never seen an underage worker in here, and you know, I've never seen an explosion. I generally feel safe. But, you know, they did have complaints. Many of them had really tough relationships with their immediate supervisor, and they felt that these supervisors sort of played favorites sometimes and unfairly punished workers for not meeting quotas.
Yeah. Now, I saw some of the video that you shot inside the factory, and we'll have it some of it on our website today. And I have to admit, the inside of the factory looked a lot sleeker and, frankly, nicer than I expected. What was it like in person, and were you surprised by anything?
This factory is one of the biggest factories in the world. It has 240,000 workers inside. It's the size of a medium-sized American city.
Yeah.
And so it not only has factory buildings, but it also has shopping centers and dorm buildings and, you know, basketball courts and swimming pools and things like that. It sort of looks like a college campus, and that's because most of the workers are between 18 and 25 years old. And so it had the feel kind of like a college campus, except it was a factory.
Finally, I was just wondering, you know, when you were watching these workers on the assembly line, what was your final impression of the quality of that work? What kind of jobs those are for these people?
Well, I think they're very boring, mundane, and repetitive jobs. However, a lot of the things that we've heard in the press, that they'd sit on chairs that don't have backs to them or they're standing up, that's not true. At least for this factory, all the chairs had backs on them. The workers seemed like they were in a comfortable position when they were doing this work. It's just that the repetitive motion of doing this work all day seemed to be, if you're doing this 8-10 hours a day, I certainly wouldn't want to be doing this work. And the workers I talked to, their plans aren't for to do this the rest of their lives. They're doing this to make money so that they can send it back home.
Rob Schmitz is Marketplace's China Bureau Chief. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Sarah.
And make sure to tune in next week. Rob will give us more details about that Foxconn factory and what workers told him about their lives there. He'll be on Marketplace and the Marketplace Morning Report. Meantime, Rob's blogging about it. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up, a Passover price war.
In recent years, particularly this year and last year, they seem to be giving away more and more of the Israeli matzah at the expense of American matzah manufacturers.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks pretty much held their ground ahead of tomorrow's jobs report. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 14 points, a tenth of 1%, to end at 13,060. The NASDAQ added 12 points, 0.4%, to close at 3080. And the S&P 500 was flat to finish the day at 1398. Financials were mostly lower. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs each lost nearly 1.75%. Retail stocks were mixed on news of strong sales in March. Ross Stores and TJ Maxx rang up gains north north of 2.33%, but fellow discounters Sears Holdings and JCPenney both shed around 1.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports unemployment numbers for March, and the Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for February. The White House hosts a forum on women and the economy. President Obama delivers remarks, and U.S. stock markets are closed for Good Friday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. Discovery is dumping its Planet Green cable channel. It was focused on the environment and sustainability. They're replacing it with a new channel called Destination America on Memorial Day. We asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to find out why polar bears and electric cars lost out to barbecues and roller coasters.
Planet Green's lineup isn't all global warming and how to reuse your old blue jeans. Discovery has already started trying to attract a new audience. This week's lineup includes Behind Bars, American Chocolate Championship, and Barbecue Pitmasters.
I've never had a turducken, but I know what they are.
Yep. So how do we get from Bill Nye talking carbon footprints to stuffing turkeys with ducks and chickens?
It was an economic decision and a ratings decision.
Tom Umstead is an editor at Multichannel News. He says Planet Green attracts only around 150,000 viewers in prime time. Discovery can grab a million sets of eyes.
It was laudable that Planet Green or Discovery trying to use Planet Green as a way to promote a green lifestyle. But in the end, it's a very niche audience.
And it turns out niche is a bad word in cable these days. Megan Mullen is author of Television in the Multi-Channel Age. She says the internet has altered the cable landscape.
Cable was going to be the new way to serve narrow interests. And then along comes the internet, and it can serve interests as narrow as just a couple people.
So niche networks have worked to broaden their appeal. For a good example, think about the Learning Channel, now TLC, also a Discovery Channel. It used to be all education. Now it's toddlers in tiaras and say yes to the dress. Umstead expects cable channels will keep moving toward the mainstream in an effort to grab viewers and ad dollars. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
So if green TV programs aren't inspiring anybody, or at least ratings, what about a graduate program in business school? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troll reports on the Green MBA.
It's a classic MBA exercise. Students research a specific company's problem and present solutions as they would in a boardroom.
We're going to start with our HP case discussion.
Today, at the Arizona State W.P. Carey School of Business, the class looks at HP, the computer company. They've studied how HP might squeeze value out of old, broken, or returned products. The team's solution, as presented by MBA candidate Joseph McCammon.
HP could implement a recycling program. Consumers can bring any kind of electronics, drop it off, so it's not just dumped off into some kind of landfill.
By collecting all electronics, HP could get more of its own products back to refurbish, resell, or get used parts. Plus, it looks good, HP generously helping people recycle all their e-waste.
As a marketing drive that, hey, we're visible in that space of recycling.
And everyone who uses the recycling program could get an HP coupon to drive new sales. Now, this isn't a huge money-making idea. But students in this class are seeking something different. They're after a triple bottom line, a solution with social, environmental, and financial gains. The class title?
Sustainability and Social Responsibility, and it's taught within the Supply Chain Management Department.
Professor Reynold Byers was new to this type of thinking when he started the class a few years ago.
It took some time for me to kind of get into this and figure out where the real business opportunities are, but they're there.
Some companies are fundamentally rebooting their business model. They no longer assume the supply chain ends when products land in customers' hands. Instead, they're asking how to cut costs on raw materials by recycling their own stock, how to reuse packaging, or find markets for used products.
It's a huge shift, actually, and I was very surprised to find those companies that were actually able to do it what looks like successfully.
Beyer says academic theory on green business is lagging behind company practice. The push to teach this mindset came from students, as they reported back from the corporate world, like Elena Medavaya.
You want to speak the language of the company.
She interned with defense contractor Pratt & Whitney, where she saw efforts to reclaim used metals instead of finding new. Other students, hoping for jobs at Johnson & Johnson or BP, noticed a push to use fewer resources, too. They're here for the same reasons as her.
It got me thinking that there is a better way to do things. So this class seemed like an opportunity to put it all together.
The impact of business education on wider society is profound.
Judy Samuelson heads an Athens Institute program called Beyond Gray Pinstripes.
I mean, business is how we get things done in society. Organizations are how we get things done that are bigger than individuals can achieve.
Her program ranks business schools on how they teach students to weigh social costs along with profits. Traditionally, she says, MBAs checked their humanity at the door.
Students enter thinking like consumers. They exit thinking like profit maximizers.
That's not great for people, the environment, or the economy in the long run, she says. If more students graduate thinking more sustainably, we might see fewer oil spills, avoid financial meltdowns. And there's a new breed of business student who wants to do good.
The kind of cohort of millennials who want to bring their heart and their brain to work.
More MBA programs are catering to that. Beyond Gray Pinstripes has seen a boom in schools that want to be ranked. And companies want to hire that skill set, too, says corporate recruiter Ellen Weinreb.
The sustainability expertise indicates that they're passionate about the bigger picture. That's valuable no matter what the function.
You won't see tons of corporate job listings with green or social good in the title, she says. It's more subtle than that. Sustainability is taking hold in every department as a lens for looking at marketing or finance or factory management. And MBAs who learn to see that way have an edge. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Been to the grocery store this week? It's all chocolate Easter bunnies and marshmallow peeps. There are also stacks of matzah for Passover, which starts tomorrow night. But apparently there is a controversy stirring in the matzah marketplace. Paul Berger reports for the Jewish Daily Forward. Paul, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I guess you recently have been investigating matzah sales, and you found that there's a bit of a battle going on between American-made matzah and Israeli-made matzah. What's going on?
Right, yeah. Well, basically, supermarkets have been heavily discounting or even giving away matzah for free every Passover for many years. But what I've found is that in recent years, particularly this year and last year, they seem to be giving away more and more of the Israeli matzah at the expense of American matzah manufacturers.
Now, is that because the Israeli matzah is a lot cheaper?
Well, yeah. I mean, you would like it if it was actually because this was what consumers want. But it all comes down to price, and the Israeli matzah appears to be considerably cheaper than American matzah.
Now, did you, in your investigation, did you find out why?
You know, matzah is a very, very simple product. It's flour and water baked for less than 18 minutes, and you're pretty much done. So, of course, the price of flour could be a factor, but according to the head of Streitz, which is an iconic mom-and-pop matzah manufacturer on the Lower East Side, really it's labor costs. Labor costs in Israel are lower than they are in the United States, and at least for the company Streitz, they just say they can't compete.
Yeah. So matzah is a loss leader. They use it to get people into the stores to sell them the more expensive stuff like what, gefilte fish or what?
Well, I don't know what there is that's actually more expensive, but I do know that an Israeli importer of matzah and other kosher products told me that the Passover shopper is estimated to be worth between $1,500 and $2,000 when they're done with all their shopping.
Wow.
So it makes sense to give away this $5 bundle of matzah at a loss.
$2,000, is that right?
Apparently, yeah.
Wow.
But you have to remember that for observant Jews at Passover time, they have to literally clear out all their cupboards, their fridge, and everything that they buy in has to be kosher for Passover. So, you know, we're not just talking about buying, as you say, you know, like matzah and gefilte fish, but we're talking about mayonnaise and applesauce as well.
Now, do shoppers care about the branding? Do American Jews want to buy American-made matzah?
Well,
there are some people out there who have a preference for a particular brand of matzah. But I think if you asked most Jews out there which was their favorite brand of matzah, they would probably say they didn't have a preference, because I don't actually think most people particularly look forward to eating matzah. In my house when I was growing up in the UK, it was a novelty, but it was a novelty that quickly wore off within 24 hours, and then you had another week of having to get through the stuff.
Yeah. Now, I got to ask you, have you done a taste test on this yourself? Have you tried all the brands?
I think that would be classed as cruel and unusual punishment. I did not put myself through that, although I have to admit that I did, while I was in the store doing research, I picked up a pack of Streit's whole wheat matzah, which I'd never had before, so I'll be opening that this Passover.
All right. Paul Berger is a reporter with the Jewish Daily Forward. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, I just saw a recipe for matzah chilaquiles. Now, that might be good. Do you have any favorite recipes for making the humble matzah more, well, exciting? If so, we want to see them. Send your recipes to us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note today, looks like bankers are the latest to hop on the super PAC bandwagon. Friends of traditional banking, they're calling it. The idea, these bankers say, is to target a few close congressional elections rather than spreading their money around to a lot of politicians, hoping they'll vote in their interests. One banker said it comes back to that old walking softly and carrying a big stick philosophy. Evidently, the banks don't think they had one already. And that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 14 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ added 12 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 was flat to finish the day right where it started. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.